Hi, John.
Hello, Oscar.
Welcome to Girona.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Just a few questions about your last book, The Intellectual Properties of Learning, A Prehistory from Saint Jerome to John Locke, and the lessons we can learn from history in how we understand intellectual property and open access to knowledge in the information age. Could you tell us how this book came out? Why you decided to write on this topic?
Okay, well, I've been working on open access, as you know, for a long time, in fact, 20 years. And in that time, I was convinced that open access to research and scholarship was a very important concept, but I didn't really have a sense of where the idea came from. Why was it so important to me and many other people that research should be free? The music of Justin Bieber, no, that doesn't have to be free. But research and scholarship, it just didn't seem right that people didn't have access to it. So I started to look into the history of the idea, of where this might have started. And I actually started with John Locke, whose theory of property is very important in many different places, but in the United States in particular, where I teach. And Locke starts from a notion that the world is given to us in common. And that from that world given in common, we have moved into areas or we've created private property, but only because it was a contribution to the common good. And so this was kind of a surprise to me because I hadn't thought property was treated in that way.
Yes.
And it also seemed to me part of, had a connection to learning, where we don't make it private because we think it does contribute more to the common good if it's not private. So that led me to look for historical examples where Locke talks about a kind of mythical America. In his examples, he talks about a biblical Eden. Mm-hmm. And so I started looking into the history, and the obvious starting point in the West were the monasteries, which were situated very nicely within here at the University of Girona. And the monasteries in the West began at the period of late antiquity, in the 3rd or 4th century. And they were based on shared property. There was no private property. And in fact, St. Benedict talks about neither a pen nor a book should be owned by anyone. And the Benedictines, this was in the 6th century or 7th century, the Benedictines were a very influential monastic order, in fact, probably the dominant one in Europe. And this communal regard, the sharing of intellectual property, found its start. Now, this is a period long before there was a term, intellectual property.
Okay.
But my book argues that as a result of this concern for learning, the sharing of learning, the communal property of learning, of people having access to learning being a very important principle, which the monasteries defended, they were closed. They were not open to the public, but that was a form of defense. They were gated communities. So I don't want to take you through the whole of the book page by page, Oscar.
Because readers need to read it.
Absolutely. And this is only a spoiler, a trailer.
Yes.
But I do want to be clear that the book comes to a point of saying that the modern concept of intellectual property, that the expression of ideas can have rights associated with it, the rights of the author or the owner, that can be sold or that can be shared. I believe that concept doesn't come from business, doesn't come from Justin Bieber, but does come from a history of learning. A history of learning associated with institutions like this university and the monastery within which it is located.
Great, thank you. How would you associate these historical connections between intellectual property and learning in 2018? We know that higher education institutions cannot afford the price hikes that are imposed by biggest publishing groups. No? For example, the wealthiest universities cannot afford the prices that are paying for accessing to scientific publications either. So what would you connect the past with the present?
Yes, so the lessons from the past are about how access is critical to learning.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to defend that principle. It is about the history of sponsorship of learning. So a very important aspect. Every monastery is based on a gift of property. Mm-hmm. Every university had founders and had contributors or donors. So I think we have to stay with the notion that the state and the public should continue to sponsor access, but maybe not at the prices that are currently being charged.
Yes.
So the book's influence is not a direct, we're not going to go back to monastic learning forms, but it is a series of principles about the importance. And one of them is to say that learning is has within it qualities that suggest a separate intellectual property category. Justin Bieber, Taylor Swift, Neil Young, and learning. And that we should treat learning differently. So we should see that the good of learning is in how freely it circulates. Now that doesn't mean that the publishers don't deserve some money. Doesn't mean that we're not getting professional services from the publishers. We are. But it means that there is no basis on which the publishers should hold a monopoly on this learning. Okay. They should be paid for their services and the quality of their services, and that's an important principle. So we need to shift the economy, and we're starting to see that. The major publishers are moving into services and away from ownership of the content because the publishers see that open access to research and scholarship is the way, the norm of the future in terms of learning, in terms of research and scholarship. So the actual price is not something this history will dictate to us. More, it's a guide on how to argue, how to think about, how to negotiate with the publishers. So what I would say is that we have an agreement now that learning should be open, research and scholarship should be open, and that we have an understanding that it should not be held in a monopoly of intellectual property, but should be paid for in terms of the services. And so in the years ahead, we will see an increasing proportion. Right now, it's about half the literature is locked up and is the preserve of libraries and those that pay for it, and half of it's freely available. So we're going to see that percentage increase. And at the same time, we're going to negotiate very hard for very good services at the price, at a fair price. That's my hope.
Thank you. You're celebrating this year the 20th anniversary of the Public Knowledge Project.
Thank you.
A project that you founded. Could you explain us what PKP is and how institutions like University of Girona can benefit from it?
Okay, I would say that the University of Girona has already benefited from the Public Knowledge Project. It is our 20th anniversary as a project. I founded the Public Knowledge Project in 1998. And at the time, it was a kind of advocacy for open access, but we became a software, open source software developer. So we build platforms, open source platforms that are freely distributed for journal publishing, for book publishing, for indexing. And it is our gift to the universities in a sense that it's free, but we do more than make it free. We support it, we upgrade it, and we ask the universities to contribute back. So in about 2003, I would say, certainly one of the early adopters was a group of Catalan journals, I'm very proud to say, and my first introduction to Catalonia was the Catalan journals, who translated it as part of a contribution, and who put up 500 journals, which I did not know about, and which were now available to the world in Catalan. So this idea that it is a gift to the universities is one aspect, but it's more of an encouragement for learning. That the work of this region, of this language, can be shared with the world. And we would ask, or we are part of a community, so we don't ask. Everybody contributes, whether it's translations, of which we have about 25 now, sometimes up to date, sometimes not. There's code translations. The open source software means that it's open to experimentation, innovation, and that any community can contribute code. And so that's been an important aspect. But I think the biggest contribution is to see the platform, the software being used used by students, by faculty, used in languages that are not well represented in, by the big publishers. And so we're creating an alternative, and we're acting as an encouragement to open access to learning.
Which is an alternative carried out or developed from the grassroots, no?
Yes, that's very nice. Much. We are very grassy, you know, we're more weedy roots, yes. Not so much grass.
Thank you so much, John, for being here.
Pleasure.